Good afternoon. This is a panel which will deal with issues of the legacy of the FSM. Indeed, the question is not just about the past, but the relevance of the past to the present and hopefully some trajectory of what we've learned in the last 40, 50 years about maybe the near future. I love the old masthead on the Progressive magazine, which said, eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. And there was something about this issue of free speech and how it doesn't go away, whether it's current issues around Ed Snowden and Greenwald and Julian Assange. Even this past week, there was something happening in Hong Kong where there was a massive student demonstration in Hong Kong about effectively voting rights and free speech. Now, the FSM was a marvel of collective action that produced some remarkable successes. Part of it was spontaneous, part of it was planned, but it produced victories on the campus that reverberated around the country and then in some sense around the globe. But movements never win them all. Movements always have their pluses and minuses, and then hindsight is always 20/20. We always know later on what it was that went right or wrong. The panel this afternoon is well equipped to address the topic, which has to do with what happened in that period about which we learned so much, some of the mistakes, but mainly I want to emphasize that the panelists should look a little bit to the current and the future and not spend too much time on the past. We're going to start with Bettina Apthecker, who was a member of the steering committee of the FSM and by all accounts one of the leaders of the movement, currently a professor of feminist studies and history at UC Santa Cruz, where she has been teaching for 33 years. Bettina is the author of several books, including The Morning Breaks, The Trial of Angela Davis. Her most recent book explains, quote, "How I Grew Up Red and Fought for Free Speech." With that, I'm going to introduce Bettina to take us on the lead.
Okay. Thank you. So I want to say we had a lively session this morning and refreshing lunch, and glad to be back for afternoon sessions, and to thank Troy Duster for so graciously agreeing to moderate our session, and my co-panelist, Michael Lerner, who on the eve of my going to jail, actually I think it was the morning of my going to jail for the free speech movement, you know, when I served my sentence, met me on the steps of the courthouse as I surrendered myself with a chocolate cake in which was embedded a saw.
Can I ask if Margie is
sure.
here?
Is Margie, Margie Wilkinson here? Margie? No. Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. And so I have always fondly thought of Michael in that moment. And my other co-panelist here, Leon Wofsy, who I remember with so much love and fondness, and his wife, Roz Wofsy, and all the support they gave to us in the free speech movement. I remember sitting on your balcony at the old home up in the Berkeley Hills shortly before I went to jail. You can see that that's a sort of moment. And having dinner with you and Roz and my former husband, who's still a very good friend, Jack Kurzweil. So Mario was there. Yes. So lots of things about today and participating in this. Well, I thought about the radical legacy of the free speech movement, and I think we each had different ideas about things we wanted to talk about in relationship to it. One of the things I can say is my students are endlessly fascinated by stories from the 60s and 70s, and they love to hear stories. And they love to get me off on tangents away from whatever we were supposed to be talking about that day. But it's also, I think, important, and I think we did this morning as well, that this is not only nostalgic, for the 60s, but also looking, as Troy said, looking forward, and also some of the lessons that were gained from our struggles in that period and afterwards. One of the things I thought about was how much rapidity there was after the free speech movement was over, in my memory anyway, of how many movements emerged and how much was happening, all of us, you know, like suddenly, as though there'd been a pregnancy that had germinated too long, and births were happening everywhere in great rapidity. And, of course, it was riding the crest of the civil rights movement. It was riding on the backs, especially of Southern black folks who had lifted this country up and out of the savagery that had governed it for so long. And, of course, immediately following FSM as well, a couple of years later, you have the election of Ronald Reagan, who used the FSM and student movement as a bludgeon with which to defeat Edmund G. Brown, who was his opponent in that election. And so that's another history, another story that I'm not trying to go into. 1969, for me, was a watershed because it was the start of the Angela Davis case. Now, Angela at that time was a lecturer in the philosophy department at UCLA. And she had been fired by the regents. And she was fired on a free speech issue. She was fired for advocating the freedom of the Soledad brothers, who were three black prisoners in Soledad here and had been framed on a murder charge. And she was leading that movement for their freedom. And the parents of the Soledad brothers, the three brothers, it was George Jackson, John Cluchet, and Fleeta Drumgo, those families all lived in Los Angeles. And that was part of how she got involved in that case. And I went down to UCLA and supported her at a rally and so on. I'd known her since childhood. And so, again, you could see the legacy of the free speech and them trying to fire her. And, of course, that was supplanted by she got hired. We forced her to be hired. And in the fall of 1969, when she gave her first lecture, it was on the philosophy of Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, and 2,000 students came. So there's nothing like trying to suppress speech to bring students out in rather large numbers to see who this person was that the regents were so excited to suppress. And of course, she was fired again in the spring of 1970 for unprofessional conduct because of her, again, advocacy of the freedom of the Soledad brothers. And then that case just simply got supplanted by her subsequent arrest and charges of murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy to commit both. So the next years of my life were totally spent in her defense. That's the book that Troy was mentioning that I wrote after the trial was over and after her acquittal. That was another huge watershed in my life and a huge mass movement that was actually international in scope, and tens of hundreds of thousands of people all over the world that participated in that movement for her freedom. What I want to segue into, we didn't have any consciousness, I certainly didn't, during the free speech movement about women's issues, women's liberation, any notion of sexism. It wasn't in our vocabulary. There had been a huge break between the early feminist or women's movements that won suffrage and then subsequent struggles. Angela Davis taught me my first introduction to feminism. And it was on the floor of her jail cell. She was invited to give a paper in the American Philosophy Association in New York and on women's liberation with Juliette Mitchell, who'd written a book called The Longest Revolution. It was a British socialist feminist. And so Angela wrote this very long paper. And, of course, she's, practically had her PhD in philosophy. So she had to teach it to me because she had asked me to give the paper for her in New York, since obviously she couldn't. So that's where I learned that we sat on the floor. We had all these books around us. And I had avoided looking at the women's liberation movement of the late 60s and 70s, primarily because I was a lesbian who was married, who was struggling with coming out. And although I couldn't have articulated it, I knew there was a connection between the women's movement and the suppression of gays and lesbians. I knew there was a connection, but I didn't know what it was. So I was very closeted, and I was shying away from it. But she wasn't. And she introduced me to all these ideas, and then I went to New York, and I did the best I could giving the paper. And just as a sidebar here, the judge in chambers actually allowed her into his chambers, turned on a phone, and she was able to answer questions in New York City via a speaker phone that were asked. There were it must have been 1,000 people in that room, and there was her voice. It was an amazing moment. December 1970, just an amazing moment. So that was my introduction, as I said. I'm very grateful. I learned a lot. And while she challenged the racism that was embedded in much of the literature that was being produced by primarily white middle-class women about women's oppression, she also took that oppression seriously, and she addressed in particular the position of black women in the society and the suppression of black women and the oppression and the interlocking oppressions of gender and race and class. So that was part of my first encounter with it. And those of you that know something about my history know that I taught an introduction to feminisms at UC Santa Cruz for more than 30 years. And it was a very enlivened class, and it was something I enjoyed teaching a great deal. And it also, from my students, each generation, teaching me new things. The media representation of the women's liberation movement focused on white middle-class women. And what I wanted to say today was it was never only or exclusively white middle-class women. The Black Women National Feminist Conference, the first one, was held in 1970. And black women's literature was very important to the articulation, especially of violence against women and issues of domestic violence. Alice Walker's publication of In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, which is a beautiful essay, was published in 1974. Natazaka Shange wrote a terrific play that was called For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough, which was very much around violence against women. So I wanted to point that out today. I think that that was part of the legacy of FSM in the sense that while we didn't have a consciousness of it, we were primed for a consciousness of it. And that even in the histories of the free speech movement, the focus is almost always on men, even though women, I'm not talking about myself now, I don't mean about myself, but women played a central role in the free speech movement. Not only in the arrests, of which almost half of us arrested were women, but also in terms of the steering committee, like Suzanne Goldberg, for example, the role of Jackie Goldberg in the movement, the role of Beth Stapleton in the movement. There's Margie Wilkinson, who was just mentioned before. There were dozens of women who were very, very important in the cohesion and collective leadership of the free speech movement. And that's, you can see then how the sexism gets replicated in the history and the representation of the history. And then you see how the racism gets replicated by focusing the history of the women's liberation movement over almost exclusively on white women and erasing the leadership and participation and insights of women of color. One of the first really important statements of the women's liberation movement was the Combahee River Collective statement, which came out of the Combahee River Collective, which was a group of black women working in Boston around issues affecting women. And they put together race, class, gender, and sexuality, where they began to talk about and articulate the suppression of gays and lesbians as related to the oppression of women, and put those issues together. So I wanted to share that with you. Very important formations were Chicana Latina women, who were involved in feminist organizing, Women of All Red Nations, which was one of the most important formations. All of these things are in the early 70s. So it's all the start of the women's liberation movement, all happening at that time. All young people, almost entirely young people, almost entirely coming out of the student movement, civil rights movement, anti-war movement. That's where the women were coming out of, with tons of experience as organizers. And then, as I said, some of the literature that emerged from that. And then you have Stonewall, 1969, which is usually heralded as the start of a modern gay and lesbian liberation movement. That's a touchstone, a very important moment in New York history and in the emergence of that movement. In the video that we saw this morning, you have a remember when Mario was talking. It was beautiful to see him, wasn't it? It was just beautiful to see him. And when he was talking, he said, he talked about the free speech movement in relationship to the hierarchies, you remember, in that segment. And the hierarchies he had was race, gender, class, environment, and imperial wars. Remember he said five? Absolutely right. And I would add to it sexuality. No. That's all right that he didn't have it. I'm not criticizing Mario, please. I just mean that, you see, one of the things we've done out of our analysis in the legacy of free speech movement, which is what he was talking about, was beginning to see the connections of systems of domination and that how they're interlinked and how important it is to make those connections. So the last thing I wanted to say was FSM gave me my voice. Do you know how this is really funny? I will share this. Clark Kerr came out right after we seized the police car, and then we had that weekend meeting to form the free speech movement. And Clark Kerr came out with a statement that said 49% of the demonstrators were communists, you remember, or communist sympathizers. And that was in the Hearst Press. It was a big headline. So we were at this meeting, and we were planning the rally for Monday, which, of course, was going to be another, you know, whatever, on Sproul Hall steps. And Mario slapped his knee as only he could do, you know, and he said, I have it. Bettina should speak at the rally on Monday. She's the only communist we have, you know. Throw it back in their faces. So I got hurled back. That's how I mean, it was totally, you know, totally serendipitous. I mean, you know, Mario's sense of humor. So anyway, that's kind of, and then I did speak at a lot of rallies after that. So the point about it is when he was talking about speech for himself, you know, and he was talking about how important it was for him, you know, I'm a survivor of child sexual abuse. And I can't tell you how important the claiming of voice was for me in the free speech movement. I came out of a radical parentage. My parents were fully supportive of my involvement in the free speech movement. That's not what was at issue for them. You know, a lot of kids, I thought, had tremendous courage in challenging their parents, you know. But my parents, I was fine. I was totally doing what they would have wanted. But personally, internally for me to speak and to say what I thought and what I felt was an enormous personal breakthrough. And so the free speech movement gave me voice in this fundamental way. And the women's liberation movement and the LGBT liberation movement gave me my life. Been with my partner for 35 years. We are celebrating our 35th anniversary this year. And we were married a year ago. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Bettina. We wanted to make sure that there was time for a lot of conversation and discussion and questions at the end. So I've asked each of the panelists to be relatively brief, even minimalist. The next speaker is Michael Lerner. Like Bettina, a member of the steering committee of the FSM. So these were two of the student leaders back in the 1964 period. Michael went on to chair SDS at Berkeley, 66 to 68. And then after taking his PhD in philosophy, he went over to Wright Institute, got a doctorate in clinical psychology, and then became a rabbi. He's written 11 books, including Embracing Israel-Palestine, and he co-authored a book with Cornel West on Jews and Blacks, a remarkable ecumenical career. He's perhaps best known now as editor of Tikkun, and is rabbi of Beit Tikkun Synagogue. Michael.
Okay. Let's see. For those of you who have never seen Tikkun, I'm going to pass around two of the latest copies. Tikkun is a Hebrew word. It means to heal, repair, and transform the world. And we believe that we are the only magazine that self-consciously proclaims ourselves as in the spirit of the free speech movement and in the spirit of the progressive movements of the 60s, trying to continue the consciousness of that time. I don't know of another magazine that says that explicitly. I came myself from a very uptight, spiritually draining undergrad education at Columbia and at the Jewish Theological Seminary, where I had become disillusioned by the absence of real spiritual and ethical consciousness and commitment. Judaism was about that, but the Jewish world and Jewish professionals and scholars were not, I found. I found that the real Jews and the FSM, anyone committed to transforming the world with an ethical vision. For me, they were the real Jews that I thought I was going to find in the organized Jewish community. What a freeing that was for me from notions that only Jews can, Jews and not so many of them either, were about building a socially just world. So for me, it was like coming home to be part of the FSM and the movement. I fell in love with the movement for that reason, and not just with the movement as an abstract, but with the people in it, including many people right here today in this room and in the other rooms here. So I had the opportunity during the sit-in to lead the Hanukkah service on the basement floor of Sproul Hall at 1 a.m. Reason was I mean, I wasn't sure that I was going to stay, but I hadn't planned it originally, but I was so moved by the rally and realizing what I really believed in, and of course I had to go. But then when it got to be close to 6 and they were saying they're going to lock the doors, I ran home to get my Hanukkah menorah, because it was the second night, I believe, or the first night of Hanukkah. It was amazing to see 200 people came to participate. It was wonderful to be with both Jews and non-Jews who could affirm with me that the liberatory message of Hanukkah was the same liberatory message as the civil rights movement, the FSM, in fact, of all social change movements. So when leaders were asked to come to turn in, so that was one major part of the free speech movement for me, was falling in love with the people and coming to see how beautiful the people were in that movement. How beautiful because willing to stand for what they really believed in and fight for it. The next turning point for me that reinforced that was a few weeks later when the leaders, but I was only on the coordinating committee. I wasn't really on the steering committee, and so I don't want to inflate my role there. When the leaders of the movement, of the FSM, were asked to come to turn in their registration cards, presumably because they were going to be suspended from school, and a few hundred of us came to Sproul Hall and insisted that we too be suspended since we had been part of that same movement. I was able at that point to emotionally break with a central part of the conditioning history of capitalist society, the conditioning history that teaches us that everyone is just out for themselves and that people are really in their core maximizing self-interest. In the decades since the movement of the 60s dissolved, the mainstream media has tried to portray that whole period of the 60s, which I'd say goes to about 1974, as sex, drugs, rock and roll. And insofar as people were not in that category, then portray them as simply caring about getting out of the draft. But this movement, starting with FSM, starting with that moment when hundreds of people came to turn in their draft cards to say, you can't suspend them without suspending us, showed me that it was not true, that people were actually, it showed me how distorted was the notion that people only care about their own narrow self-interest, because it was against our self-interest to potentially lose our scholarships and our student status when we came to turn in our registration cards in solidarity with our leaders. So those were two great things that I learned, the beauty of people and the lie that we're taught that people only care about themselves and that people will never be motivated by a higher vision. And that second lie still keeps so many people from engaging in a continuing transformation movement on the thesis that, well, it's me and a few friends of mine who want a different kind of world, but everybody else wants something different. I learned this actually when in my recent years when we started an organization that we call the Network of Spiritual Progressives, though by spiritual we don't mean believing in God necessarily or being religious, but we do mean putting primacy on love, caring, and kindness and generosity in the world. And I gave a talk to a group of 200 Methodists in Kansas, and about the new bottom line that we're proposing, a new bottom line of love and caring and kindness, so that instead of judging institutions, corporations, government policies, our healthcare system, our economic system, our legal system as efficient, rational, and productive to the extent that they maximize money and power, we need to judge it efficient, rational, and productive to the extent that it maximizes love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhances our capacity to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, and enhances our capacity to respond to the universe with awe and wonder at the grandeur of creation, and not looking at the universe simply from the standpoint of, is there anything here I can turn into a commodity and sell? So I gave this talk there, and 200 Methodists standing and applauding and cheering. And then lots came up to me afterwards and said, but it'll never work. I said, why? Well, they said, well, we know what America's like. You see, we read the newspapers. We know what the people are like on the West Coast or the East Coast. We see them in the television. We read them in the newspapers. They're all interested only in themselves. It's only Methodists in Kansas who would want a new... But whenever I talk about why people should join our network of spiritual progressives, whether you're spiritual or not in any conventional sense, but you should join together to come out of the closet with this new bottom line and affirm the need for a world based on love and caring and kindness, people say to me, well, you know, us people in New York, Washington, Boston, San Francisco, Los Angeles, we can get behind this. But middle America, they'll never buy it. And it's held by so many of us that our ideals are only narrowly shared by a few people, and that everybody else is just interested in self-interest. So these were very important things to learn in the FSM. I also, in the 60s and in the period thereafter, because I know this is part of what we're about today, I learned a few big problem areas about the movement of the 60s that made them less powerful than they could be. Number one, there was a tendency to demean middle-income working people, deriding their religious commitments in particular, or saying that the reason that they were not with us was because they were ethically deformed in some way. And this persisted, as far as I can see, right to this present moment in the social change movements, a tendency not on the part of the most sensitive leaders, et cetera, but in the popular culture of the progressive movements to assume that the reason why the majority of Americans aren't with us is because they're racist, sexist, homophobic, white skin privilege, or just plain stupid, and that otherwise they would be with us. Now, and that gives credence. First of all, most people who hear about the liberal or progressive world, they don't necessarily know all the intricacies of left thought, but they do know when they're being condescended to. They do know when they're being put down. And that has been a central part of why the movements of the 60s have not been more successful, was that all through, right up to the present moment, whenever we don't get a majority with us, when we try to explain why we're not more successful, we talk about the rest of the people as though they are all deformed in some way. And that message gives tremendous credibility to people to the ruling elites who have decided that one of the ways to discredit the left is to call us elitists. That is, the real economic and political elites of this country use the claim that we are elitist. And the fact is, they're partly right. because there has been this tendency to put down other people who are not with us and to assume that the primary reasons are their deformations, rather than asking what is it that we're doing or what is it that we're not doing, either one, whether what we're doing or what we're not doing, that could speak to people in a more effective way and to speak to their deepest needs. And so that's been a big problem. There's secondly, the demeaning of our own leaders. I saw this happen throughout the 60s. I was roommates with Jerry Rubin, and I watched him, very creative guy, nevertheless, be put down for every time that he came up with some creative idea. Eventually, he became an egomaniac. But that egomaniac part was to compensate for the lack of recognition and the put down that he and so many other leadership people had. And I spoke to people. I actually did a survey of this in the early 70s when I tried to create another organization called the New American Movement. And I went around the country talking to people, and so many of the people who were the most creative leaders in the 60s in various social change movements told me that they didn't want any part of it. Why? They still believed everything that progressives thought, but they felt that they had been so abused for being leaders in their own movement. We did not have a way of dealing with leadership that could, on the one hand, support them in a real way and really appreciate them, and hence, on the other hand, democratically control them. So people had to choose. If you want to be a leader, you're going to either take abuse or you're going to separate yourself from the democratic movement and act as an elitist. It was a terrible conundrum. And so one of the things that is was part of the reason, I believe, part of the reason for our lack of success in the later years is our inability to adequately support leadership inside a democratic structure. The next thing that I came upon is the inability to recognize that there is a deep spiritual crisis in America. And a spiritual crisis, why? Because there's a deep religiophobia in the left. It comes from the Marxist tradition, from the putting down of religious people. It fails to recognize that actually the most successful movement we had in the 60s was the movement led by Martin Luther King Jr. and others out of the churches of the black churches of the South, and that that there is within the religious world deep spiritual values that are positive that can be built upon. Instead, a lot of people in the progressive and liberal world came out of a very negative experience, and I totally understand why there's a religiophobia in the left, because of the racism, sexism, homophobia that really does exist in some sections of the religious world. But that has generalized to a general antipathy towards religion. And when I wrote this book that became a national bestseller a few years ago called The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right, and went around the country speaking about this, I met so many people who told me, hey, I used to be part of a progressive movement, but I couldn't stand it because they put me down all the time. One young lady said to me, I just had this experience last week, she said. I met some guy. He was kind of interested in me. I was kind of interested in him. He called me up and said, can we go out for breakfast this Sunday morning? She said, no, I can't make it Sunday morning. I'd love to see you, but I can't go Sunday morning because I go to church. He said, church? I thought you were liberal. And that assumption that people in that world, it turns out that 60% of Americans identify themselves as religious in some way, actually more. But 60% say that they go to church at least once a month. I don't know if it's an exaggeration, et cetera. But people feel from the left a discounting of a spiritual reality, of a religious reality. But meanwhile, what I was discovering as a psychologist when I headed the Institute for Labor and Mental Health, and we did a study of the psychodynamics of American society, trying to understand why people were moving to the right, and what we learned was that for a large number of people, they were moving to the right because they had come to believe that the only place that on the one hand, that they were feeling as though their their work was meaningless, and they were surrounded by an ethos of selfishness and materialism. They looked around and seemed like everybody was just out for themselves. And the only place where that was being spoken to was by the religious right. They were talking about the breakdown of family life that was a product of global capitalism, of the ethos of selfishness that people were learning in the workplace day in and day out. But instead of a left coming forward to understand and articulate that issue and to help people understand that the personal crisis in their life was connected to the economic and political structure of a society that validated selfishness and materialism as the highest value, instead, we were putting them down. So that was a big, big mistake, to not recognize that actually at the core of our isolation as progressives is the spiritual crisis that so many people are facing, and we don't articulate and provide a progressive framework for addressing that. And finally, I'll just say that the inability to recognize and be able to talk about love, caring, kindness, and generosity, these are seen by people who are the leadership of the liberal and progressive world as soft. And we have to be hard in order to show that we can deal in the world of politics as it exists today. And I came to the conclusion, and that's part of why we started Tikkun Magazine and the Network of Spiritual Progressives, that it's critical to talk about these value issues. You know, read today's Times, there's a values conference in Washington, D.C. Why is it not our conference, a values conference? Why are we not speaking about love, kindness, and generosity? The triumph in the left of a narrow focus on political rights and economic entitlements has narrowed the capacity of us to speak to some of the most fundamental hungers that people have. So I believe that hunger was actually beautifully expressed and articulated in the days of the free speech movement, but it has been relegated to the side. And although most people in the left come to the left for that very reason, because they are loving and caring and kind and generous people, but then learn to be realistic, and being realistic in this context means not articulating these values because they don't have any place in politics. On the contrary, in my view, they should be the center of a liberatory politics to talk about what it would take to build a world based on love, kindness, generosity, ethical and environmental sensitivity, and awe and wonder at the grandeur of the universe. So thank you.
Thanks, Michael. No one doubts that the students were the engine of the free speech movement. They had come; many of who were in leadership roles had come back from the South in '64. They had been in the Freedom Summer, and came back to campus. And as most of you know, who followed this situation, tried to express themselves in Sproul Plaza and other parts of the campus. That was the leadership of the movement, but it was clearly all about students. What's also very much important in the movement was the role of faculty. And what suggests the famous vote of the Senate back in December of 64 was the role the faculty played in the side rooms, the back rooms, and kitchens and living rooms around circling the campus. And key among them was the next speaker. Leon Wofsy, one of the most important faculty leaders, playing a vital role, supporting and advising not just the students but other faculty throughout the whole period. And for the next 20, 30 years, every progressive movement on campus, Leon had a role. He's a professor of molecular cell biology. He joined the faculty the exact same year of the free speech movement. Leon came to Berkeley in 1964. Although new to the campus, he brought a wealth of experience as an organizer and political analyst, and was the wise and equally impassioned advisor of the moral imperatives that Michael Lerner just talked about. His memoir, Looking for the Future, is available online in the Free Speech Movement Archives at the Bancroft Library. Leon.
Thanks, Troy. I'm sorry I wrote my remarks up, but I want to be – I'm hoping there's time for discussion. You can't hear me? Okay, I'll do my best. I've got an old voice, and I'm trying to save some of it for discussion afterwards because I think a lot of very important questions have already been raised. The title of this panel is a subtitle is Wins, Losses, and Monday Morning Quarterbacking. And I guess I'm going to deal with two of them. I'll pass on Monday Morning Quarterbacking. The fact that there was a backlash and that Reagan and the right exploited it was, in my opinion, not in the power of FSM to prevent. The movement unleashed great energy and spontaneity, and no leadership could have fine-tuned it to both achieve its goals, the goals of the FSM, and to avoid unleashing the fury of the right. That doesn't diminish the wins. FSM did win against a stubborn and violent resistance from a paternalistic administration and a corporate-dominated board of regents. It won recognition that the First Amendment applies and is binding within the university. That battle produced, that win was the inspiration for similar free speech eruptions on campuses in every part of the country and around the world. And free speech turned out not to be simply an abstraction. It sparked challenges to arbitrary authority. It soon merged into a powerful upheaval in opposition to the war in Vietnam. The radical legacy of the 60s generated significant cultural change. It loosened the prevailing norms of society. It made serious inroads, especially among young people, against society's deeply rooted taboos that suppress social interactions and personal relationships. In the aftermath of the upheaval, the women's movement and the historic fight for gender and sexual equality burst through traditional restraints. The radical legacy of the 60s didn't begin and end with the FSM. Nothing quite matches the remarkable heroism and overall significance of the civil rights struggle in the South. And of course, FSM has recognized how much of its own inspiration flowed from that. Before the FSM and since, the radical legacy confirms that moral courage and persistence, renewed by new generations of youth, can make important headway on vital social issues, even as the political and economic system becomes more reactionary and oppressive. That, however, is a huge and growing challenge for society. How it's met depends on more than radical hopes and actions. A serious change, of course, becomes possible when events finally prove to the broadest majority that the present course is disastrous. Case in point, Vietnam, if you remember the transformation that took place. And it wasn't because of the left, but the left was with it. It would seem that evidence of failure, of things falling apart at home and abroad, is beyond denial. But here we go again, and we have to face that. So as we celebrate the radical legacy of the 60s, it's more than a matter of modesty to recognize that new generations will need some answers beyond what's gone before. Now I want to use this opportunity to acknowledge a debt. FSM gave something very important to faculty who came to its support. It gave courage and a sense of community with the students. Soon after FSM prevailed, students and much of the faculty used their free speech to protest the Vietnam War. Governor Reagan, who had conspired with J. Edgar Hoover to oust UC President Clark Kerr as too liberal, felt that speech shouldn't be free after all. And when students and faculty decided to hold a Vietnam commencement supporting graduating seniors who had pledged not to fight in Vietnam, Reagan and the regents banned the event. But it took place anyway, thousands filling Sproul Plaza and 300 faculty standing together on the steps of Sproul Hall in direct defiance of the ban. The threatened punishment failed to materialize. Later still, During the region's effort to eliminate People's Park, Governor Reagan ordered the National Guard to the Berkeley campus, unleashing tear gas indiscriminately from swooping helicopters. A delegation of faculty went to Sacramento to plead for sanity, and when the government called them in for a tongue-lashing in front of masked news cameras, the faculty delegation took him on and actually achieved a remarkable favorable coverage by the media. So FSM isn't the end of the fight for free speech. For some, it continued in support of efforts for affirmative action and establishment of ethnic studies. For many more, it carried on to divestment of UC's holdings in apartheid South Africa. And that didn't come easily either. I remember President Gardner walking over a Charlie Schwartz, who's in this room, who was lying down in opposition to the UC, and swearing that he would just like to, what, crush you? Anyway, that didn't come easy. At UC, a small yet significant number of people of color gained entry to the faculty for the first time, although student enrollments failed to become representative. FSM turned out to be an important part of many lives, my own included. We have every reason to be proud of what happened at UC, of the spirit that added to the university's greatness.
I'd like to thank all the panelists for keeping inside the time limits so we have plenty of time for discussion. Before we get to the hand raising, let me make a mid-air correction, adjustment. There are two microphones here at the front of the room. The original plan, which I approved, was to have people come forward. But I think because of the size of the audience, I'm going to change that and ask for two volunteers to help take the microphones to the seats. A volunteer? One. Another volunteer? Good. Thank you. The back. So the microphones are here in front. There's a microphone right here. And now, as best I can, I'm going to moderate this, I'm sure, an audience with lots of questions and lots of concerns. Let's start right in the very middle. So the first... Identify yourself.
I'm Jim Block, and I've spent the last 50 years writing and teaching, basically trying to figure out what happened in my sophomore year of college. And so I want to just offer really quickly a couple of thoughts from a long history of with what happened at Berkeley. My own analysis as to what happened, what its successes, and why it wasn't more successful. On the one hand, I would say that it was successful beyond all measure. That what it revealed was a fundamental hollowness in the way that Americans live, a lack of being in touch with their own realities, with their own selves, of living lives that were roles and scripted and so forth. And they didn't, without the joy, the pleasure, the meaning, the spiritual intensity, FSM, to me, revealed that, made that palpable, gave me a language to begin thinking about it. It also, because it was Berkeley, and I was at many of the campuses of the movement then, because it was Berkeley, it wasn't just the campus. It was a whole community that had sort of gone into the independent state of Berkeley. It was already living in a kind of way that wasn't articulate, a kind of new way of life that was post-material, post-repressive, post-paternalistic, post-patriarchal, etc. So it really created this, it really opened that up. That's, to me, a success that will never go away and is part of the continuing history of America. Where it wasn't more successful is because I think we and a lot of the country has realized over the last 50 years that is going to require, that journey to that way of life is going to require enormous changes in who we are, the way we live with each other, the way we have communities and caring and democracy and family and nurturing. And we've taken a break from the spiritual rigor of that kind of a journey. I think it's ahead of us, but people are scared of taking the step that it takes to move on to a new kind of culture and society. So I applaud the FSM and those who were my elders who taught me that a sophomore year can be a turning point. So thank you.
Thank you. Here's what I plan to do. I'm going to take another three questions, three observations, and then turn to the panel for a response and then go back to the audience. Yes.
Yeah, my name's Sue Ellen White, and my comment is a bit of Monday morning quarterbacking and a bit of looking to the future. I've been an activist since college. One of my experiences, and I identified with Patina, is becoming part of the feminist movement. And the reason that I became part of that movement was a response to the New Left, which was part of the cult of personality and demeaning of women. And Michael, you were part of that as part of the Seattle Liberation Front, and I lived in Seattle, so I have you to thank in part from feminism. Gotta be honest here. And I think that the New Left drove that, and women were demeaned and were left out, and a lot of things happened around that that drove us to find our own movement. And so one of my questions, I think, for the panel is, who are we leaving out now? And as we look around in this room and we think about college students now and young people now and the constraints that they operate under, which you never had, most of you went to school for free at Berkeley. And now, we ran into a young man in an ice cream store who said he had dropped out for a year to work so he could go back the next year. So it's a very different situation. So who are we leaving out now, and how can we bring them along in a way that is not demeaning, that is respectful, and that includes all of us?
Thank you. Yes.
Here you go. Thank you. My name is Judy Gumbo Albert. I arrived in Berkeley after the FSM in late 1967, and I want to pick up on something that Leon said, and also let you know as part of the legacy of the FSM, and that is anti-war activity. Last year, in 2013, I had the opportunity to visit Vietnam to help celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Paris Peace Accords. And everywhere we went, from Madame Bin in Hanoi to down through Hue to Ho Chi Minh City, there were signs that read, and people would say to us, warm welcome and gratitude to the American anti-war activists. Gratitude to us. Gratitude to every single person who struggled against the war. And that is kind of the message that I came back with, and that I see is also a legacy of the FSM, is that we helped end a war, and the people who fought that war are grateful to us now.
In the very back. Yes, in the back. This will do.
Hi, my name is Steve Jacobson, and I was on the committee to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the free speech movement. And at one point, at one of our meetings, one of the people on the committee, she raised her hands, and she said, "What good were the '60s? You know, we got Reagan, and now we've got Bush." To which I immediately said to her in the committee, I said, "You know, our movements may not have lasted forever, but they're going to be a great model for future generations." And sure enough, I was a part of the Occupy movement here in Oakland. And, you know, the movements in the 60s were always referred to in Mario's speeches. So the movements, the free speech movement and the other movements will live on forever.
I'd like to stop here for a second and invite any panelists to respond to the question about who are we leaving out.
May I speak to that? That's a really good question. As someone who teaches at UC Santa Cruz, I see these students struggling to pay the fees, and they're astronomical. And when I tell them what I paid, even as an out-of-state student, you know, they can hardly believe that anything like that existed. And when I talk about the 1962 Master Plan for Higher Education in California, which really had the idea that there was never to be tuition for public universities, in this, that's written into the master plan. And that's why they're called fees and they're not called tuition. If you look at the language, they call them fees. They're thousands of dollars, 12,000. I mean, unbelievable amounts of money that these kids, and of course the parents are also trying to very often help their children to go through school. They mortgage their homes. They sell their cars. They work double and triple jobs if they can get them in order to try to get them through. And then Reagan was the one that invented this idea of student debt. He was the one that proposed the loans. And I just wanted to say about this, the loans are draconian. You can't get rid of them. You can't refinance them. Elizabeth Warren tried to propose in the Senate very recently to have a bill that would allow you to refinance at lower interest rates that was defeated. They had a majority, but not a sufficient majority because of the Republican opposition. So it's really, this is really important in terms of the economics of the student population now and the difficulty that working class and students of, and or students of color, they often overlap, have in trying to go to the university. And it's not only the UCs, it's also the state university and it's also the community colleges. So I wanted to say that. The second thing I wanted to say about who gets left out are immigrants. The problem of immigrants being able to get into university, and especially undocumented students. And we have a whole program at Santa Cruz, I'm sure they have one here also, to try to protect undocumented students so that they can get into school and so that they can pursue their careers and so forth without being outed and deported and et cetera. But for me, that's a very important category. And I also live in a community. Santa Cruz is adjacent to Watsonville, which has a very large Chicano Latino population. And about a significant proportion of our student body is Chicano Latino. And some significant proportion of those folks are undocumented people. Including, you see, their children that were brought here and so on. So I would say that category is really, really important.
Thank you. A hand in the very back, and then we'll go left. Yes.
Thank you. Two things I would like to ask about. My name is Jack Rady. I'm a free speech movement veteran, Vietnam Day Committee, and a whole lot more since. We don't have time for all the rest. The first concerns leadership and decision-making in the movement, and Michael alluded to it. In the free speech movement, we were mercilessly democratic. Meetings went till goddamn 2:30 in the morning so everybody could be heard, and so we would talk until we could come to agreement. And as a result, we managed, with a few hiccups here and there, to stay together in our broad coalition because we respected each other enough to listen and find a way, okay, what can we agree on? Let's do that, and let's stay together and stay strong. It meant that leadership came out of and was connected to its base and the broader community we were trying to reach, and did not simply go off based on its own brilliance, passion, and devotion, but really listened as well as spoke, and they spoke so well. This kind of got lost after that when democracy began to kind of drift away in favor of charismatic leadership. And the connection, of course, we had a simple thing. We had one campus. We had one issue. It had been brought to us. We didn't raise it. So we had a built-in community. But the attempt to keep the movement connected to a community later on became much more tenuous and caused some problems, one of which was the second point I'd like to make, which is, and Jack Weinberg made this point at one of our reunions 10 or 20 years ago, and I think it's a good point to remember. We were fabulously successful. We turned out lots of people. We blew our own minds and everybody else's because of coming out of the so restricted 50s. the thing broke open and we could call a demonstration. We had 10,000 people, 50,000 people, 500,000 people. We are the world. We were going to stop the system all by ourselves. And we began to see ourselves in the mirror and be God damned impressed. And we forgot that there were a couple hundred million people in the country and we hadn't convinced them all. And it was sort of the victory disease. We started off with a wonderful victory, and the energy's carried me 50 years, and I'm sure that's true of most of you. But we lost sight of our sense of proportion and our own humility. We began to be legends in our own minds, and we separated ourselves from much of the community in the country that basically agreed with us on a lot of issues, but had a hard time getting past the hair and all that crap. That meant, if I was still quite as active as I was, I'd be well advised to make this a little shorter, and this talk too. So that's my question.
Back left.
My name's Kat Zavis, and my question is, so earlier today there were probably about 100,000 people at the Bears game, and there's not nearly that many people here, and most of them are not of a younger generation that are here with us today. And so my question is, how do we inspire the younger generations to take on this mantle and continue the amazing work that was done?
Leanne.
I'd like to get back to this question of who are we leaving out. I'd like to challenge the question. We sometimes talk as if we can control everything if we only did things right. It just isn't true. If you look at the struggles that go on, and they get more and more difficult and more intense, you can make two points. One, a point for optimism, and that is that no matter how bad reaction gets, as far as the government is concerned, we've been through an extremely reactionary period, and it's getting worse, it's still possible for movements to accomplish things, and it doesn't happen from the top. Civil rights didn't come from Jack Kennedy, and it didn't come from Lyndon Johnson. So that's one aspect. One aspect is that there never are conditions where a morally strong and determined movement can't wrest gains and can't accomplish certain things. And FSM was a very good example of that. There's a second question, though. You can't ignore the political and economic system, and you have to give some thought to the fact that it isn't simply a matter, while I agree with a lot of what Michael and Bettina said, it isn't simply a matter of morally transforming a population. We can do the best we can, but it also is a matter of trying to think real hard about what's happening. We're in a situation now where things are falling apart, where there is a major political crisis of function in the United States, where America's role in the world is undergoing major transition. A crucial question for the future that involves everything from climate change to nuclear catastrophe is whether a change can be made in the course that America is following in the world. That's a big question. We can't accomplish it, but we sure as hell better think of it in our mind. And that's why I used the example of the Vietnam War. Was it important that when there was a vilified minority that we fought like hell to end the Vietnam War? Yes, it was absolutely important. But could we end the Vietnam War by ourselves? No, we couldn't. It had to involve not just... It had to involve a change in the whole population. And it had to include some objective factors. It had to include the fact that the war was a losing proposition. We're now confronted with the fact that we have losing propositions all over the place. And the big question is, what is going to change America's course? We can't do it, but sure as hell we better keep our eye on that. And that's what I mean by the need for a certain amount of modesty and humility, not to minimize the accomplishments we've made or the accomplishments we can make, but to be realistic about looking at the world and recognizing that objective conditions play some role too, and it's not just a matter of what we will or won't do.
I think Michael wants to respond, and then I'll take three more questions from this side.
Yeah. Right. Well, objective conditions, in part, are have to include the consciousness of the people of the country. And changing the consciousness of the people of the country is a central part of what made it possible for us to play an important, not the only, but an important role in stopping the war in Vietnam. And I was very honored when sitting in the federal penitentiary for having organized a big anti-war demonstration, J. Edgar Hoover testified or sent a message to the court saying that I couldn't be released from prison even for the appeals court, to appeal in the appeals court because I was one of the most dangerous criminals in America. Whatever got him to think that way, I mean, it was, you know, when he was thinking that I was, you know, okay, anyway, crazy. But what I wanted to say is two things. Number one, yes, we need to deal with objective conditions, and it's not enough to simply say, as I said before, love, kindness, generosity. We need some programs that embody that, and that's why the Network of Spiritual Progressives has proposed, and I urge you to come to our website, spiritualprogressives.org. Number one, a global Marshall Plan to once and for all end, not just minimize, just not ameliorate, but to end global and domestic hunger, poverty, homelessness, inadequate education, inadequate health care. But number two, the environmental and social responsibility amendment to the Constitution, which we propose, which number one requires a public financing of state and national elections and no other money allowed, period. All other money banned. And number two requires that every corporation with an income of above $50 million a year, not talking about mom and pop corporations, be required to have a new corporate charter once every 5 years, which would only be granted to those corporations which could prove a satisfactory history of environmental and social responsibility to a jury of ordinary citizens, and getting testimony from all over the world about that. So the point is that you have to have both love and caring and kindness as your vision, and you need some concrete programs, and I urge you to read those programs because I think they will turn you on when you read them, the details of it. The second thing I want to say is this, is that to answer the question of what can we do to reach out to people who are not with us. And here I just want to say, Martin Luther King Jr. did not become an icon of social change in this country by giving a speech that said, "I have a complaint." I have a complaint. No, it was having a dream. It was having a vision. Unfortunately, much of the social change movements of the past many decades has focused too much or primarily on what our complaints are and not enough on what we are actually for, not enough putting forward to the world a vision of the kind of world we actually want and trying to detail that. So we need to build that, and that's part of what it is to be a spiritual progressive, is to try to engage people in envisioning in every profession, in every workplace, what would it look like if really there was a new bottom line? What would the world look like that we're actually for and not just what we are against?
All right, so I'm now going to return. I'm returning to the middle of the audience, which, Robin? There's a foot. This is coming.
I'm speaking on behalf of Hale Zukas here, who has spelled out for me this following little vignette. In 67 or 68, he donated his draft card to the bonfire, so his draft board, which was in New York, ordered him to report for induction. So Hale went to Leon to talk about what he should do. "We decided," says Hale, "that I should report. But first, I had to have the induction transferred from New York to Berkeley, and I had to make that request in person at the Berkeley Draft Board, which blew my cover.
Thank you. Okay. I ignored the middle of the audience here. The question here, yes.
Hello. My name is Michael Weinberger. I live in Vermont, but I came to California to go to professional school. I'd done other things first. I didn't come here to be a progressive. I didn't come to be an activist. My family were activists in New York. I felt they did the job. But I was raised very much to believe in the American Constitution. I had a constitutional lawyer father. And when the university tried to close down conversation, I understood that that was contrary to my needs and my beliefs. I very much believed in open conversation, and I continue to feel that that's essential to a free society and to making any progress. Currently, though, as a non-religious Jew, I find that conversation about Israel is closed. I play poker occasionally with a group that includes a rabbi who was thrown out of his congregation for suggesting that Palestinians had human rights and that they were human beings who had to be respected. The other day, I was in Ohio. I happened to meet a woman from New York, and she told me, she's not Jewish, she told me she was afraid to talk to her Jewish friends about Israel. I find this an incredibly dangerous and frightening concept that within the United States, a group that has typically stood up for individual freedoms and the respect of human beings is no longer doing that. So I would ask you if, just to address that issue.
I think I'd still like to take two more and then come back to the panel.
Hi, I'm Julia Stein. One of the things that FSM did brilliantly was out-organize the administration. We were brilliant organizers. I mean, incredible, given that we were like 17 to 25. One of the things I think the 60s didn't do very well and the 30s I think did much better was articulate a vision of another America or United States or culture which would encompass most people in the country. And you see that other American vision like in John Ford's movie of Grapes of Wrath, or you see it in Dorothea Lange's great photos. You know, those are great photos most Americans, you know, identified with, or they identified with the Grapes of Wrath. And we didn't have that vision, and I think we need it now, an encompassing vision of a more equal America, you know, a more ecological America that we could all participate in. So I think we can also learn from the 30s a whole lot, because I think they did reach out for most of the country. They did really try very hard.
Renee, I guess I was Goldsmith Kaczynski in those days. I was arrested in the free speech movement and continued to be an activist. But I just want to make a positive statement. I recently participated in the big climate march of 400,000 strong, and I think they did include, the reason it was so successful is it was inclusive, just like the free speech movement, the right, the left, the center, and a bigger vision. So I just want to underline that if we want to include many more people, all of us, that, and it included, it started out with the indigenous people, and it had the labor unions, it had almost every movement I've ever participated in, the feminist, and most of all, it was joyful. So we had a lot of fun. So I think that we need to keep that going. And it is happening everywhere. So we just have to keep those links.
I think Bettina wanted to respond to the question about the silencing of conversations about Israel and Palestine. Bettina?
Yeah, thank you. I just want to acknowledge that wonderful climate march in New York. If you haven't seen the pictures, go online. It's fabulous. And it was also completely interracial, as you said, with the indigenous people, but also African-American, Latino. Everybody was there. and it had a huge, and so that's part of the inspiration. I'm Jewish, right? And you are absolutely right. There's tremendous intimidation. It's coming, I think, from the Jewish right, which is very conservative. That's how I see it. And it shuts down discussion through various forms of intimidation, including cutting off funding to universities, for example, who allow faculty who question. I'm not talking about some kind of – it's pretty moderate. Some of the positions that people take are pretty moderate is what I guess I was trying to say. They fired Stephen Saleta from the University of Illinois in Champaign, Palestinian-American who was hired and was already hired in a tenure-track position to teach Native American studies and was fired before he ever got to the campus after he had abandoned a tenure-track position somewhere else and had already been hired. And there's a big lawsuit there and there's a big fight going on because he had sent some some messages that were very condemnatory of the Israeli invasion of Gaza. And it was strong language and so forth, but he has a right to freedom of speech, and it isn't what he was going to be teaching. You understand what I'm trying to say? You know, so and we see this all the time. I happen to be someone who really embraces opera, and an opera by John Adams is called The Death of Klinghoffer, and it was supposed to be broadcast on a high definition from the Metropolitan Opera House this fall, where it's being performed, and there was this, again, a relatively powerful but small, it doesn't represent the entire Jewish community at all, that put pressure on the Metropolitan Opera to cancel the HD, the high-definition performance of it. It's not even going to be on the radio. And The Death of Klinghoffer is about a Palestinian group that takes over a ship and actually executes one of the Jewish passengers. And so you have this kind of censorship that's going on. And any of us who are involved in temples or Jewish organizations or whatever, I know that Michael has endured tremendous, he's a hero from what has been done to Michael. I just want to say that. Michael has done incredible things in trying to maintain some sanity. And yes, it's very frightening. It's very frightening. And of course, the thing is, we must not be intimidated, and we have to be able to speak about these issues. There was an interesting piece in Reform Judaism, which is the official magazine of the Reform Judaism movement in this country. It was written by a rabbi making a plea to allow debate on the Middle East and to not suppress people who questioned Israeli policy. I was very impressed with that because he was a mainstream rabbi in the Reform movement and he wrote that piece. So I just know that that's it's very difficult. It's very difficult. And the point is not to be intimidated. We have to not be
Thank
intimidated.
Thank you. I'd like to have a quick response from Michael who wanted the microphone, and then I'm going to turn it to the last three and we're out of time. So Michael.
Yeah, just quickly to say that Mario Savio and I sat from 1968 to 69 drafting a paper called the Committee for Progressive Middle East, in which we put forward views that are now mainstream in the liberal world, but at that time weren't so much, about what a two-state solution could look like. It was printed in Judaism magazine, and the editor of the magazine was fired for printing it. In my life, more recently, we honored Tikkun was set up as, in part, the voice of progressive Jews, and in relationship to Israel, we became persona non grata in synagogues around the country for taking that stand at a time and starting in 1988. More recently, we honored Judge Goldstone for his role in articulating what was wrong, what was happening in Gaza in the last criminal acts, in my view, that were taking place there. And my house was attacked four different times, physically attacked. There's paint thrown at it and written all over the outside, you're a Nazi, you're an anti-Semite, you're a self-hating Jew. But one of the things that I noticed is, you see, part of the reason why that right wing in the Jewish world has been so powerful is because they make this their number one issue. And so when we went to, we have done Tikkun, and our network of spiritual progressives has gone to Congress, tried to work with people to take a different kind of stand. And what they say to us, including some of the best liberals that you know in the country, say to us, look, Rabbi Lerner, it's crazy for us to take a stand on this because you will be, and your friends will be with us in the election at any time because of the 10 other issues that we stand for. But this group will be against us and may make the difference between our victory and our non-victory because they will make it their number one priority. And what I've noticed is that liberals and progressives who feel strongly about this issue have it as their 10th or 12th priority. Unfortunately, that means that they don't fund they don't subscribe to Tikkun. They don't fund organizations. The Voices, we are the only magazine in the Jewish world that speaks out absolutely in favor of the rights of Palestinian people, not just why getting out of the West Bank is good for the Jews, but why it's good for the Palestinians and the suffering, not just of Israelis who are suffering from this struggle, but the suffering of the Palestinian people and maintaining, as we do, that Palestinians are equally valuable to Jews and that their lives and their souls and their suffering is equally important. And yet the liberal and progressive world doesn't support us and doesn't stand up on this issue in a strong way. And that's part of why the more reactionary voices become so powerful.
All right. I'm going to use the voice of the chair as a moderator and take three last questions and comments and then turn to the panel for the last word. Back.
High school for...
Identify yourself, please.
I taught in... Oh, Steve Platt or Cassie Platt, as you wish, or as I wish. But I taught in... I taught in inner city high school for 20 years. I had families of Palestinian kids there who were in America. I was told more than once, I said, do you ever go back? They say, no, we can't go back. We've been here. If we go back, we'll be killed. And I'm not making that up. And they did not mean killed by the Israelis. Anyone who wants to know how Jews actually feel about Palestinians need to read the parts of the Bible about how Jews are supposed to treat people, which is with love, caring, compassion. And if you want to know immediately what's being said, look at The Forward, which is a terrific Jewish newspaper and has all the views in it, including views written by people who are Palestinian and not even Israeli Palestinian. And look at Haaretz, which is an Israeli newspaper, and try and compare that to what would happen if any sort of dissident information was published in Gaza and how those people would be treated by Hamas. And additionally, look at the Hamas document, its founding document, and what it says about Israel and two-state solutions. The problem with a two-state solution is really not on the Israeli side. I don't like Netanyahu. I don't like the settlements. But the problem with the two-state solution, it is very clear that the other side, if we talk about sides, is not at all interested in any two-state solution.
Let me ask if there are particular responses on the FSM legacy for the last two. Yes.
Hi, I'm Henry Hitz. I was in Sproul Hall 50 years ago. Arrested. I wanted to respond to the question about who's being left out. One of the things about the free speech movement that many commentators have said, but I don't think is part of the general legacy of it, which is really that it was the civil rights movement, that it was a part of the civil rights movement, and it never should have been separated from the civil rights movement in the way that the media, I think, did, and you know, created this illusion of there's a student movement and there's a civil rights movement. No, it was really all one movement. And in light of that, There's a book which probably many people have read called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, who talks about the mass incarceration issue, and those people are being left out and you know, literally left out of everything. And we're talking 1970, which is, you know, right around that time, there were 300,000 people in prison in the United States, and now there are 7 million. So that's a huge number of people being left out, and that definitely needs to be included in any movement that we try to build.
Thank you. Last, right here. Last comment.
Okay, I'm in a room full of Jews, and there's one thing that I haven't heard mentioned, which was, I'm sorry, I'm Anya Paradiso, and I used to be Ann Lubar. And the thing that isn't mentioned is something that some of us were discussing back in 64. I happen to be the child of 100% disabled World War II veteran. So World War II lived in my house. And I read a lot about World War II. And one of the things that was really crucial wasn't all the battles that were won, but the Nuremberg trials. And nobody's brought that up. And one of the things when I was becoming radicalized that I was trying to figure out was I did not want to be a good German. I did not want to sit back and say, well, this isn't, you know, my problem. I don't really know what they're doing. This was important. And there were a number of us who were discussing it back in the 60s. And I think that that's something that needs to be revived, the whole what we learned from the Nuremberg trials, and that we have responsibility for our own morality no matter what the government tells us. And there's going to be one of the crucial anniversaries of the Nuremberg trials coming up, and I think there should be an emphasis on it and teach the kids about it and why that was important. Anyway, thanks.
Okay, fine. All right, I'd like to invite the last words from Bettina, Michael, and Leon. Bettina.
Okay. I think the I'm not going to try to say too much substantively. The discussion was great. I really appreciate the discussion. And you can see the political sophistication that was true in FSM, and there, and here you are, and it's still the case, you know, all these years later, and all your experiences and everything. I find in working with the students today, the big obstacle is not about the issues, at least among my students. And I teach, sometimes my classes have 500 students in them, sometimes 200, whatever, you know. The main obstacle is that they don't believe they can make a difference. They don't understand the power of mass movement. And I spend a lot of time trying to teach that. Critical thinking and mass movement, you can make a difference. And I invoke again the spirit of FSM in terms of inclusion, community, generosity, loving kindness. We see each other now 50 years later, and there's a love that's, I feel it. I think you do too. You know, that you just feel like, wow, were you in Sproul Hall? Do you remember that? You know, it's like, oh, whoa, yeah. There's an immediate connection. And I try to teach that to them, that that kind of spirit is, they have to produce it. They have to produce it themselves. They have to produce community. And it's not so much convincing them about the issues, at least among my students. Oh, they may need to be more informed or whatever, but that's not really what it's about. Their hearts are beautiful. What it's about is persuading them that it is possible for them to make a difference by uniting together in a movement. And I think that's why the climate change movement was so important just the other day. And I also think that's why the Occupy movement was so important, that you had that sense of a rising and a community. And insofar as we can impart that, that I think is a wonderful thing as FSM vets that we can give to the younger generation. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael. Michael, a few last remarks.
Yeah, well, two things. Number one, that although the ultra-democracy of the FSM was beautiful at the time, it was based on the lives of students. And one of the things that we need to create and that unfortunately Occupy didn't create, even though I loved Occupy and was down there lots and lots of nights, is a form for people who have children, for people who have jobs to get up to for the next day. They can't stay at meetings that go till 2 in the morning or even till 10 at night. And so we have to not use the old forms. We need to create some new forms that mean that people will not be able to endlessly talk and debate out every issue. That's one point. So that's one point. The second point is that, and this is building on what Bettina said, you know, there's this thought of, well, why aren't there more young people here? What can we do, et cetera, which I think is an important thing to address. But I also think it's important to not negate who the people are here and our generation, because we are not dead yet. And we are and the fact is that the energy here and the smarts here and the experience here is desperately needed. I want to invite you to our movement, the Spiritual Progressives, but if that's not it, find whatever is the movement that you want, but don't spend the rest of your life saying, I did it then. We need you. We need your energy. We need your smarts. And you can make a huge difference in this country if the people of our generation were to take the next 20 years and instead of accepting the definition of what's possible that's given to us by our political leaders, including our liberal political leaders, whether that be Obama or even more liberal people in the Congress. Don't take their definition of what's realistic. Go define what is your highest vision of the good and spend your life energy, your money, your whatever you have to give, give it to your highest vision of the good and don't settle for anything less. Yeah.
Lean forward.
I'll pass.
Okay. I want to end. I have a request. I began with a quote from Progressive that eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. And I'll end with that. But Robin Room had a special request, and I'll give him the microphone to see if he can lead us.
Okay.
It suddenly occurred to me that at one point in the free speech movement, when things were not going very well, the meeting ended with everyone singing, "We All Live in the Yellow Submarine." And so... why don't we all join in that?
We all live in a yellow submarine. A yellow submarine. A yellow submarine. We all live in a yellow submarine. A yellow submarine. A yellow submarine.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much for your attention. We are adjourned.